right. What I'm going to try to do is kind of build off what Mitch has presented. The idea behind my presentation, assuming it actually comes up, is to take a lot of the things that he talked about, or at least a handful of those things, and explain to you how we look at it from the science standpoint and what kind of science we are looking at as we're trying to accomplish a couple of other things that Mitch talked about. If I tried to look at all of it, it would actually take much longer than the time we have. So I'm not going to do that. I have no relationships to disclose. One of the things we have to deal with, because of the product standard, the standard that we have to use to assess everything we do, which is the population health standard, we have to look at science from a very broad standpoint. Instead of looking at it from a very narrow focus, we have to look at it very broadly. And so there are three main areas that we look at. First thing we look at is we look at the product. And related to the product, we look at chemistry, we look at engineering, we look at microbiology. And that tells us things about the products themselves. We also look at the tobacco product user. And what's the impact of some of these decisions on the user themselves? So we look at toxicology, pharmacology. We look at addiction. We also look at product use behavior. How do people actually interact with and use the product? And finally, we have to look at the population as a whole. So we have to look at environmental assessment, which is a requirement with everything the federal government does. We look at epidemiology. We look at consumer perceptions. How do they view the products? We do statistical analysis, and then we have an evaluation component to help us understand, are we doing the things that we think we're doing? And so I have the wonderful opportunity, which is really terrific. I come from a laboratory. I'm used to interacting with chemists all the time. But I now get the opportunity to work with engineers and with social scientists and with toxicologists and bring all that together to try to understand better what's the way that we can use the science to be most effective. And so I'm going to talk about three things. Three of the things that Mitch has really already talked about. One is restricting product changes to protect public health. Secondly is prohibiting modified risk claims that state or imply reduced exposure or risk without an order. And third, decreasing the harms of tobacco product. So first, talking about product changes and restricting those product changes and the authority we have there. Now, products are changed. We know products are changed regularly. The manufacturers modify these products. They do it for a number of reasons. They want to increase their product share. They want to increase the people that are using the number of people using their products. They do use it to attract new users. They are losing users every day, and they have to bring new people into the share of product that they're using. They adjust to supply. They adjust to supply issues that are occurring out there where they have to modify the product. And they also want to retain current users as those users' preferences change. So we know that the manufacturers do make changes to their products. We also know that experimentally. This is data from when I was at CDC, and we were looking at unprotonated free nicotine in different types of products. And these are Skoal Bandits. And we actually did some studies between 1999 and 2004 and found out that those products during that period were down at a very low level of free nicotine, what a lot of people refer to as starter products. They're products that allow and make it possible for new users to get in, and so the nicotine is not so intense, so irritating that they can get into those products. And there's, for some reason, between 2004 and 2006, they made changes. They decided they were going to reformulate their products. The free nicotine levels went up dramatically. We don't know why. We don't understand why they did this. But as of 2009, if the companies choose to do that, it's got to come through FDA first. They can't do this unless it comes to us first. Now, Mitch talked about the three pathways to market. And no product, let me make this very clear, no regulated product can be changed or first introduced to market after March 21st, 2011, without FDA evaluating the science and issuing a marketing order. Now, there are three pathways they can go through. The first of those is a new tobacco product application, and that is the primary statutory pathway to market. And they have to go through a pre-market review process where the standard is, would permitting the product to be marketed, would that be appropriate for the protection of public health? As Mitch said, and as I'm sure you've heard and everybody's aware, 480,000 people dying every year from tobacco use. That is not appropriate for the protection of public health. It is not appropriate that 500,000 people die prematurely because of tobacco use. So making something appropriate for the protection of public health means that number needs to drop. It means the number of people that are dying and are getting disease from tobacco products has to drop. That's my interpretation of what this means. That's what's appropriate for the protection of public health. To date, we have received and filed no new product applications. Instead, the industry has used a second pathway, which is called substantial equivalence. Substantial equivalence is an alternative to new product applications. And it's used when the characteristics are the same as grandfathered products. Those are products that are on the market February 15, 2007, or the characteristics are different, but the product does not raise different questions of public health. And in those cases, they can provide a substantial equivalence application, which we will review and evaluate. As Mitch said, we have begun review on all the regular SE reports that are in-house. We have reached conclusions on 45%. One of the things Mitch didn't point out is that most of the products that have been withdrawn after we have issued a deficiency letter to the companies, and then they have withdrawn their applications. We're also actively reviewing the provisional SE reports, which we are prioritizing based on the potential they have to raise different questions of public health. So we have 4,000 of them, and so what we're doing is we're looking at which ones are the ones that are most likely to raise different questions of public health, and those are the ones we were reviewing first. There's a third pathway called substantial equivalence exemption, and it's an alternative to substantial equivalence in cases where the only change is to an additive, where the product change is minor, and we can conclude that a full report is not necessary to ensure that permitting the tobacco product to be marketed is, again, appropriate for the detection of public health. So all of these, even the different questions of public health pathway, are all focused around the issue, what is appropriate for the protection of public health, and that's how we view these issues and the marketing of products. Now, there are a number of things that we look at. When we go in and begin to dig into these reviews and trying to understand what can impact the product, and as I said, we go all the way from engineering to human perceptions when we're looking at it. Let me just point out a couple of things. One is we look at engineering. Everyone in the room may be aware of this, but the cigarette is a very highly engineered product. It is not just a roll of paper with some tobacco stuffed inside. It's actually very highly engineered and designed. And so we look at things like the paper porosity, because the rate of oxygen moving through the paper will actually impact the temperature of the heated product and will change the levels of delivery of constituents. We look at things like tip ventilation. Tip ventilation serves to allow air to go into the product and dilute the air as the user gets it. The user senses then a less irritation, and they make the connection that product may actually be less harmful because of that connection. We look at tobacco blend. I'll talk about that in a little bit more. We also look at things like resistance to draw. Smokers expect a certain resistance, so when they pull on the cigarette, they expect it to feel a certain way. If it does not feel the way they expect it to feel, they have certain perceptions of what that product means. So we look at engineering about those products and how that engineering changes, how it might affect delivery, and how it might affect people's perceptions of the product. We also look at tobacco blend changes, and this is data from when I was in CDC, and just to make it a little bit bigger, again, you may be aware that the U.S. American cigarette is not just a single form of tobacco. It's actually a blend of tobacco. There are a number of different types of tobacco that go into what's known as the American blend. Burley, Bright, Oriental tobacco, reconstituted tobacco. These all go in making what is called the American blend, and these things can have very different levels. For example, NNN levels, N-nitrosonornicotine, which is a carcinogenic tobacco-specific nitrosamine, has much, much higher levels in Burley than it does in Bright. So if you have a higher percentage of Burley, you're going to have a higher amount of the carcinogenic tobacco-specific nitrosamines in the product. Not only NNN, you also have much higher levels of NNK. So the way they do that blending is critical for us to understand what is the likely impact of that on public health. Modified risk tobacco products is the second thing to talk about. Modified risk tobacco products means any tobacco product that is sold or distributed for use to reduce harm or the risk of tobacco-related disease. And sold or distributed is actually a very broad term that we use. And y'all are familiar with the ads that occurred before and the tobacco industry's claims around their product, and that's why the law was written. That's why these aspects of the law were put in. And so, again, as Mitch kind of highlighted, what we're doing when we're looking at modified risk is we're looking at the balance between the possibility, the likelihood of increased harm versus reduced harm. And it's not just harm to the user, it's also the possible harm to the population. And so we look at these aspects, and we're going to have to weigh those aspects and try to determine what's the likely outcome. Now, we look at the modified risk parts of the statute as a tool. How can we use this tool to help reduce death and disease from tobacco products? But we look at the evidence that's presented by the industry to us so that we can modify, or so that we can look at this and make the best decision about what's the likely impact of the decision we're going to have. One of the big advantages we have in the Tobacco Control Act is the post-market requirements. Industry is required to provide us data post our decision while they're marketing for a certain number of years. And at the they're required to provide that information to us. We assess that information, and there is a limited period of time when they have the authority to make that claim. When that time is up, they can no longer market that product with that claim unless they come back to us and prove to us again that that claim is still valid and can be used. And that's to allow the possibility that we don't know absolutely what is going to happen, but we know the likelihood, and then we can allow us to gather more information to understand if our assessment is correct or not. Now, third thing, decreasing the harms of tobacco use. I think all of us in the center believe this is the most powerful part of the statute that gives us the authority to reach back not just at new products, but to reach all the way back to products that are already on the market. We know that kids come to the products because of their appeal or attractiveness. They're then hooked by the addiction of the product, and that eventually leads to disease and death. We know that. And so we're looking at the possibility of product standards and how we might impact the products that are already in the market to try to reduce those things. How do we cut between non-use and experimentation? How do we prevent experimentation leading to addiction? And how do we prevent addiction leading to death and disease? Fortunately, the tobacco product standards parts of the statute gives us very wide-ranging authority. The Congress was very smart in providing a very wide range of things we might be able to do. And so here's some of the things that we're discussing, some of the things that are out there, some of the things that may be worthwhile directions to go. For example, we know, everyone I think in the room would agree, that smoking cessation leads to better health outcomes. This is known for a long time. So in any way we can encourage cessation from smoking, that is a good thing. On top of all of that, studies have been done recently, and this is a study by Neil Benowitz, it's about 7 years old, but it's been repeated in other places, using participants who were not interested in quitting. Going into the study, they were not interested in quitting at all. But Neil introduced them to some reduced nicotine products over a period of 6 weeks. As they used these products, it was very interesting at the end, 25% of these people who were not interested in quitting when they started the study, spontaneously quit. They just decided it wasn't worth doing anymore. They were actually able to give those products up. That's very intriguing to us as a possible strategy. Also, data from CDC before, one of the things that is clear, because of the different blends of tobacco, there are wide-ranging levels of particular toxic chemicals in different forms of cigarettes. And this is data that shows Marlboro cigarettes and versus local brands. And what you see in the red are Marlboro cigarettes that were bought all around the world, and the green are local brands of cigarettes by contrast. The reason the Marlboro cigarettes have so much higher nitrosamines is because of the levels of burley, the burley that's introduced in the American blend that's being used in those cigarettes. Not only is it in the cigarettes and in the smoke, but we also see it in people. So if you look at people who have been normalized to the amount of intake they have of smoke, people in New York and Minnesota have significantly higher levels of tobacco-specific nitrosamines in their body than people in Australia and Canada, because people in Australia and Canada smoke cigarettes that have bright tobacco and don't have burley tobacco. So there's a significant difference in these levels of carcinogens. Dave Burns out at UC San Diego actually published a study. It was a very elaborate study looking at trends over time and came to the conclusion that Canadian male lung adenocarcinoma incidence rates are actually lower than those lung adenocarcinoma incidence rates in white men in the United States. And this is likely due to the differences in design of those products. And so we're trying to understand more about that and what actions we might be able to take to reach back and to have an impact on the toxicity of the products that are there. That was cancer. If you start looking at non-cancer, you also see some very interesting things. And this is a theoretical non-cancer hazard index. I'm not saying the numbers are absolute, but they're very interesting. If you look at non-cancer causes of disease, about 85% of the theoretical cause of disease is due to acrolein. Acrolein is a chemical. It results from the burning of organic matter. And so when you burn tobacco, it generates acrolein. It's been estimated, again, that about 88.5% of the non-cancer hazard from tobacco use is due to acrolein. And we already know you can reduce acrolein. Philip Morris has already done it. They actually marketed a cigarette called Ultra Smooth, which they had on the market for 6 months to a year, where they put very large amounts of carbon in the cigarette filter and actually significantly reduced the levels of acrolein. So it can be done. Whether that's the right thing to do or not, it takes a different assessment, but it's possible to do it, even no matter how they smoke it, whether they smoke it lightly or whether they smoke it heavy. We're also very interested in things like tobacco pH. We know that there are different forms of nicotine, and so on this chart it shows what happens when the pH of the product actually changes in smokeless tobacco. And there's a particular area where there's an equilibrium between the protonated and the unprotonated form. Protonated form of free nicotine, or the protonated form of nicotine moves across the membrane slowly. Unprotonated form moves across the membrane much quicker. It's analogous to what you get with cocaine and crack cocaine. If you take cocaine and you freebase it, which is what this is, then you can get the cocaine to the brain quicker. Similar situation you can get with nicotine. It's really analogous to that. And so if you can move the product more to deliver more unprotonated nicotine, you get a much bigger impact of that in a much more addictive product. Now, this is looking at 40 different U.S. brands of smokeless tobacco and the unprotonated levels. And what you see down in the lower left-hand corner are products that, again, we would call starter products, products that are designed for kids. The kids then move up the ladder till they get to the area with the large circle, which is really where most adult smokers stop. If you're a real man, you move up on farther and you really get a big dose of nicotine. But I want you to look at the difference between what's Copenhagen Regular up there on the kind of upper right, and then Skoal Bandits, which is, again, interestingly enough, the earlier version of Skoal Bandits. And look at the difference between the free nicotine levels. Because when you go in and you look at plasma nicotine, depending on what the actual free nicotine levels are in those products, it delivers the nicotine much quicker. And so for Copenhagen, you get a much faster delivery. You get a much higher delivery. For Skoal Bandits, you get a much lower delivery and much slower delivery. And so there are certain characteristics of the product that are very interesting and may impact the appeal of the product, impact the addiction of the product, and may impact the toxicity of the product. Finally, as Mitch said, we're putting a lot of money out there. We're putting a lot of money on the street for research to try to help us to understand what's the best actions that will take place and that will have the most impact and long-living impact. So we're looking at diversity of tobacco products, which includes e-cigarettes, cigars, water pipes, other products like that. Reducing addiction, reducing toxicity and carcinogenicity. What are the adverse health consequences of use of the different products? We're looking at communications. How do we talk to kids? A lot of the stuff that Mitch showed is required research looking at how do kids understand and how do you best communicate with kids. We're looking at marketing. What are our options around the way products are marketed? And then we're looking at economics and the policies that we have to best do research. And so these are our 7 research priorities. We are moving forward with those areas. But the clear thing is what we need to do is establish that scientific foundation so that we can build upon that. Everything we do within the Center for Tobacco Products is built upon that scientific foundation so that we can move forward. Thank you.